Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As of this weekend, more than half of Californians are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That's according to the state's website. And that number continues to grow, albeit at a slower pace. Ahead on Insight, I tag along with a tenacious, spunky group of nurses at Woodland Memorial Hospital. They're taking to the streets to reach vulnerable populations unlikely or unable to access traditional drive-up or walk-in vaccination clinics. We're going to share their mission of quality over quantity. Plus, the Yolo Causeway is home to an annual migration, Mexican free-tailed bats, and hundreds of thousands of them at that. The Yolo Basin Foundation will join us later in the hour with their Bat Talk and Walk summer programs, which offers a front row seat to this colony taking flight. And dates, they are selling out fast. But first, a ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas passed the two-week mark. This followed 11 days of violence last month, killing hundreds, including children, most of the deaths taking place in the Palestinian territory of Gaza. And this is the most severe outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinians since 2014. It is a conflict that is long, painful, and complicated. To help us get a better understanding, we're joined by Ron Hassner, a political science professor and Middle East expert at UC Berkeley. Ron actually joins us live from Tel Aviv, a roughly 17-hour flight away. Welcome to Insight, Ron.
Hi, Vicky. It's a beautiful sunset here in Tel Aviv.
You're about 10 hours ahead, correct?
That's right.
You know, to give us a better sense of place, how far are you from Jerusalem, Gaza, and the West Bank?
So Israel is tiny. All of Israel would fit easily between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Jerusalem used to be 45 minutes away, and then they built an express train, so now it's only half an hour away. The Gaza Strip is by car an hour and a quarter to the south of me. Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia are all about 2 hours away.
Can you differentiate why political scientists such as yourself, they prefer Palestinian territory as opposed to Palestine?
The term, so it's slightly nitpicking. The term Palestine is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. It refers often to a territory that existed in the past, which was the British mandate over Palestine that was not a country, but it was an area which included today's Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories that the British controlled after the First World War. Palestine can refer in the minds of some people to a future Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but Palestine also refers in the minds of many people to the whole package, all of Israel and all of the Palestinian territories. So when protesters in San Francisco last week held up signs that says, Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, they're referring to the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, and they're talking about ethnic cleansing. They're talking about eliminating Israel and replacing it with a Palestinian state in all those territories together. Since Palestine is not yet a state, does not have a voting seat at the United Nations, it's more accurate to refer to it as the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza.
And there are rival political parties within Palestinian territories. You have the Palestinian Authority as well as Hamas. Hamas is not recognized by the United States or Israel, and the United States designates them as a foreign terrorist organization.
That's right. It's fair to say that they're not just rival, but they are more rival to one another than they are rivals of Israel. They are at a significant degree of enmity. That's another reason why Palestine is not technically a state. It doesn't have a government. There is the Palestinian Authority, which is the unelected government in the West Bank, with which Israel and the United States have a series of peace agreements, and a good deal of cooperation, which is why the latest conflict was not a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. There was no conflict in the West Bank. It's a conflict between the Palestinians that are ruled by Hamas, as you said, a recognized terror organization, in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is tiny, tiny, tiny. The Gaza Strip is about the size of sort of inner city San Francisco.
Well, it's been a little over 2 weeks since a ceasefire took effect between Hamas and Gaza and Israel. What is the political environment and mood there? I mean, you're in Tel Aviv. What conversations are taking place?
So the mood right now, depending on who you talk to, is rather turbulent inside Israel. The focus is now not on Hamas and the Palestinians, but on the very real possibility of a brand new Israeli government that is unprecedented, not just in Israel's history, but in Middle East politics. It'll be a government in which conservative religious Jewish parties together with left-wing labor progressive Jewish parties together with right-wing fundamentalist Muslim parties joined together in an effort to replace Benjamin Netanyahu and solve some of the internal tensions in Israel, which the Gaza conflict brought out. There are ethnic tensions inside Israel. There are difficulties for Israelis who are Muslim and Arab, both how to relate to the Jewish majority in the country, but also how to handle the fact that their country is at war with Arabs on the other side of the border. That's not a new problem. And so there's, I think, tremendous optimism on behalf of many, including many in the United States, that this government is going to sort of open a whole new realm of possibility in terms of peace accords, in terms of settling tensions between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews in Israel, in terms of investing more among minorities in Israel. I'd say it's a moment of optimistic turmoil.
You know, this conflict, these tensions, they date back more than 70 years following World War II. And you were just talking about, you know, individuals, people outside within the government. I mean, there are Israeli and Palestinians who are neighbors and they live alongside each other. What is the current relationship now?
So the conflict lasts, a solid 100 years. It was not caused by the creation of Israel as much as it caused the creation of Israel. Contrary, I think, to common misperception, Jews and Muslims did not live peacefully in the Middle East alongside each other. That's in part why the State of Israel was created. And the State of Israel, as it stands today, is mostly made up not of European Jews, but of Middle Eastern Jews, Jews who had to flee Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, etc. There are moments of optimism and there are moments of difficulty. Conflicts like the conflict with Gaza raises issues of loyalty. It's unfair and it's frustrating that Israelis who are citizens of Israel but happen to be Muslim or Christian are both animated to conflict against their Jewish neighbors. So there have been lots of synagogue burnings in mixed communities. But at the same time, it's frustrating that these Muslim and Christian Israelis are targets of attack and discrimination. So, you know, you could imagine, it's a strange thought experiment, if you've imagined a war between the United States and Mexico, and the United States would not wait for Mexico to launch 4,000 rockets. I think the United States would probably initiate a war after the second rocket. But if you imagine a war between the United States and Mexico, and you can imagine what that would do to relationships between Latino Americans, white Americans, African Americans, it's sort of that scenario playing out. Now that all these parties are sitting together for the first time in history, I mean, it's unthinkable in any other Middle Eastern country, right? What other Middle Eastern country has Muslims and Christians and Jews sitting together in a parliament? But it's even unthinkable, I think, in Israeli history. So I think that gives a great degree of hope. And there's a lot of work going into healing these rifts right now.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with UC Berkeley political science professor Ron Hassner, who's currently in Tel Aviv, about the recent tensions between Israel and Palestinian territories. Now, you just touched upon this, but expanding on it, both the Israeli and Palestinian governments are unstable. How does instability within individual governments further exacerbate tensions?
Oh, that's a sort of an interesting poli-sci question, right? Just for my students who study these things, one thing that happens is leaders who are insecure might try to rally for war in order to get more of the population behind them. That is alleged in part on Benjamin Netanyahu, that he certainly didn't cause the recent conflict in Gaza. That conflict was caused by Hamas, but that he benefited indirectly, although it seems he didn't because he's about to be replaced. So I think that's sort of one suspicion. One also worries about how effectively a government like that functions at a time of war. To what extent does the outgoing prime minister consult with the incoming prime minister about military decision making? So that's on the Israeli side. On the Palestinian side, you know, it's often said that Israel is reluctant to negotiate with the Palestinians. It's not quite clear who to negotiate with. There are two, not just two separate Palestinian governments, but there are two rival Palestinian governments. And one of the greater underlying causes of this recent war in Gaza is the fact that the Palestinian Authority, ruling over most Palestinians in the West Bank, had declared democratic elections for the first time in almost 20 years, then figured out that Hamas was probably going to win those elections and canceled them. And that's what drove Hamas to a state of despair. And that's when Hamas started provocations and rockets fired both at Jerusalem and at Tel Aviv and at other population centers. So the split government means that negotiations are very, very difficult to conclude. It's not even clear to the Americans who they should negotiate with, since, as you said, Hamas is a internationally recognized as a terrorist organization.
That leads me to President Biden. He has a long history with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, back to his early days as senator, we're talking back in the 1980s. Does this longstanding allyship complicate or actually help navigating this recent chapter in tensions?
It's an awesome question. And if Netanyahu were not on his way out, it would be a serious consideration. I think Biden would really hold Bibi's, that's what Netanyahu is called here, would really hold Bibi's feet to the fire because I think Biden is quite tough when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and holds Israel quite wisely to accountability. Bibi's on his way out. And the truth is the United States does not have a great record when it comes to helping on the Israeli-Palestinian front. Not since Bill Clinton in the 1990s has a president successfully brokered a single Israeli-Palestinian negotiation. Not Bush, not Obama. The Palestinians did not even respond to Obama's peace overtures. It's not that they rejected them. They didn't even respond to them. Certainly not Trump. Biden has a very, very ambitious domestic agenda. I don't see Biden having much of an international agenda anywhere. Biden's not pushing hard on Russia. Biden's not pushing hard on Hong Kong. And if he doesn't deal with these really big conflicts, like Hong Kong, Crimea, why would Biden deal with a small neighborhood conflict like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? He doesn't have any particular leverage over the parties. And it's not clear that there's anybody to talk to on the Palestinian side.
Does that explain why he took a diplomatic distance from this recent conflict? I mean, it was Egypt that brokered the ceasefire.
Correct. And Egypt does have a stake. Both Israel and Egypt border the Gaza Strip. So the Gaza Strip actually has two borders. The closure of that border is an Israeli decision and an Egyptian decision, because Hamas declared war on Egypt and on Israel when it first took over the Gaza Strip. So Egypt is concerned about Hamas. Egypt is also concerned about its own Hamas, which is called the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt. And Egypt and Israel have a very longstanding and a very good peace agreement. So Egypt has credibility. Egypt is reliable. The United States has done little in the Middle East in the last 10 years other than pull out and leave. So other actors like Russia and China have come in to fill that gap. I don't think that's a good thing. Not for Americans, not for Palestinians, not for Israelis, but it's a reality. The United States is focused more and more on itself and on its own problems. That is certainly Biden's agenda. Coronavirus, healthcare, unemployment, discrimination, racial issues, I think that's quite appropriately his focus. And it's not clear that he can offer a solution to a 100-year-old conflict that his predecessors haven't thought of before. So he condemned the Palestinian rockets on Israel, 4,000 rockets in just about a week. He called on Israel to be as restrained as it can, as it's trying to target Hamas while Hamas hides behind Palestinian civilians. And that was pretty much it. Blinken came to a visit. Blinken met with the head of the Palestinian Authority. He met with Netanyahu. It's not clear that any progress came out of those meetings.
Yeah, I was reading an interview you did with Berkeley News, and that was last month. And you taught war in the Middle East this past spring. And that was a course that brought home some troubling realities for a class that included both Muslim and Jewish students. Can you take us back to navigating the types of conversations that took place last semester?
Yeah, so I should clarify, it's not a class about the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's a class about war in the Middle East in which, and I know this will sound strange to many Americans, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the smallest war happening in the Middle East and has always been the smallest war happening in the Middle East. There have been about 500,000 fatalities in Syria in the last decade. There are over 200,000 fatalities in Yemen right now. The fatalities from this last round in Gaza, based on the best reports I've seen, have been about 100 civilians and 100 terrorists. So it doesn't even, by political science standards, count as a war. It's a counterterrorism operation. So we focus on the occupation of Western Sahara by Morocco. We focus on the occupation of Kurdistan and Cyprus by Turkey. We focus on the Iran-Iraq conflict and on the tensions between Iran and the Gulf countries. We also touch on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The big challenge in teaching something like that in a Bay Area campus is to get students to understand that these conflicts are not just complicated, but that there is no single true way of reading them. That where one starts one's historical analysis, who one listens to, how one defines actions, which analytic framework you use, which theories you rely on, yield different answers. So the big challenge is to get students to think about conflicts from multiple vantage points and to warn them that if anyone ever has a simple explanation for them on any conflict in the Middle East, that person's trying to sell them something, right? And so, for example, we make very sure to read Palestinian narratives next to Israeli narratives, Shia narratives next to Sunni narratives, Arab narratives next to Persian narratives, to show really that the point of view that you take on a conflict really completely changes how you diagnose the problem and the solutions you offer. And I have to say the students were very happy with the class, even though it was by Zoom.
Oh, right. And hopefully it'll be in person soon.
It will definitely be.
Just in the final 30 seconds we have, you know, this is the most significant violence in the region since 2014. Do you have optimism moving forward?
So again, I'll say it's the most significant conflict in the Israeli-Palestinian territories. In the region, I mean, again, an hour and a half away from me, there is a civil war going on that kills more people per week than this conflict between Israel and Hamas. Yes, I have to say I have a good deal of optimism. I think Israel really managed to do a tremendous deal of damage to Hamas infrastructure, including to the Hamas research and development facilities that were in this Associated Press building. I think they may have set Hamas back a solid 10, 15 years. That is not a long-term solution to the conflict. So I'm optimistic short-term, and I have no positive or negative hopes for the future. I'm hoping that this reshuffling of the deck on the Israeli side might perhaps lead Palestinians to reshuffle the deck on their side and finally push for a representation that is neither corrupt, like the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, nor homophobic and genocidal, like Hamas in the Gaza Strip.
UC Berkeley Professor of Political Science, Ron Hassner, joining us from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for the clarifications, the context and perspective, and safe travels back home.
Thank you, Vicky.
Up next, quality over quantity. I tag along with a group of Woodland nurses. They are putting foot to pavement to close the vaccination gap. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As of this weekend, more than half of Californians are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That's according to the state's website. And that comes out to about more than 18 million people, and another roughly 4 million are on their way with one dose. But there are certain groups of people walking into a traditional vaccination clinic just isn't really realistic. They are unable or unlikely to make an appointment and physically walk in or drive through to get vaccinated. In Yolo County, Woodland Memorial Hospital is literally hitting foot to pavement to close that gap. Their mobile vaccination clinic is reaching out to homebound seniors, people with disabilities, the unhoused, and also the uncertain. Since January, they vaccinated more than 4,000 people, and some just simply needed someone to answer their questions and concerns to turn that I don't know or that outright no into a yes. I tagged along with the mobile clinic in Davis on Friday. You'll meet Woodland Memorial Hospital Chief Nurse Gina Bravo, Nurse Susan Gonzalez, Hospital Administration Manager Janine Rogers, and Yolo County Homeless Services Coordinator Nadia Wagner. The group literally walked down streets waving people down, asking if they've been vaccinated, needle in hand.
I'm Gina Bravo, and I'm the Chief Nurse and Chief Operating Officer for Woodland Memorial Hospital.
Gina, if you could just kind of explain what we're doing right now, what we're walking into.
Yeah, we're walking into a respite center where people experiencing homelessness can go and take showers and have meals, sit, hang out. And so there's some people in there that are interested in getting vaccinated. So it's really exciting when we can get this vulnerable people that we have to go to. Let me see.
Is it a doorbell?
Yes.
It seems like you were pleasantly surprised that you found some individuals that were willing.
Yeah, it's really hit or miss when we go to these places. Sometimes you go in and there's a lot of people, and then sometimes there's nobody. Sometimes you see me and people scatter. But we actually were fortunate. We had a couple folks come up and were excited to see us. So that's really a good day, a good start to the day.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you guys want to go in the shade area?
Yeah, let's do the shade right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Hello. So we will have you start filling out this paperwork.
You know, when you're heading out to individuals that are unhoused, is it kind of a mixed bag if they want to proceed or not?
It is. There's a lot of those unfortunate myths or conspiracy theories out there that this vaccine, you know, harms you in certain ways or makes you different. And a lot of that has circulated amongst this group. So some of them are afraid of it. And then others are really willing, like these two today, to come and get it. So it is, it's really divided. And then there is a few of them that sit kind of in the middle. And after a good conversation, most of the time we're able to convince them into getting the vaccine.
You started this back in January. How many people have you helped? Talk to us about the demographics that you're helping.
Yeah, I mean, there's thousands. I would say probably close to 4,000 people we've probably hit this way. For the demographics, it's definitely the underserved. But when you break that down, the elderly community is one that we hit, and especially the vulnerable ones, the ones that live in the low-income zip codes, the ones that don't have transportation. We've gone out to mobile home parks, senior apartments, then we'll go to individual homes for people that are homebound. The migrant farm population, that was a really, really fun group of people, and one that we really wanted to get our hands on and be able to vaccinate them, just because they live so close together and work so close together. And probably the most thankful group that we've had so far. I mean, they were just so thankful, and we were able to, when we were doing the workers, we allowed them to run home if they live close by and get family members. So they brought all their family members. Many of them are undocumented, so they don't have access to health care. So really, this was great to be able to get that. We like to brag in Yolo County, 83% of that population has been vaccinated, which has been great.
The migrant farm workers.
The migrant farm workers. 83% of them have been vaccinated, which is just huge. And then the people experiencing homelessness, that's another big population. And for those, we go into encampments. We go to the ones that are in the Governor Newsom's Project Room Key program. We go to all the hotels. We actually go into the encampments under the freeways, under the bridges, on the side of the roads, those sort of things, the train tracks. Also, at the end of the day, from our clinic, so if we're doing a big clinic at the hospital, if we have extra vaccine, we take the vaccine into the encampments and use our last shots that way. So we've been able to get it. And then just low-income folks that for one reason or another, don't have good access to health care. We're doing clinics. We've done clinics in neighborhoods. We've done at maybe schools in that area. We went into different markets where English isn't the predominant language and gave it in the market. So all those kinds of outreach to people.
Like what you're talking about is y'all are really foot to pavement. You're hitting the pavement. What have you learned from doing all of that?
You know, the biggest lesson we learn is when this vaccine first came out and everyone was excited and it was like the light at the end of the tunnel and we were thinking of a healthy future. And really the question is do we really have a healthy future when our most vulnerable isn't healthy? And it really opened your eyes to that we all in a community have to be healthy from the most vulnerable to the least to really be considered healthy and safe.
Are we ready?
All right,
come
we're ready.
Over here on this side.
Hi, sure. I'm Susan. How are you, Matthew?
Oh, right there.
You're doing okay? All right. Relax your arm. Relax your arm. There you go. Perfect.
My name is Susan Gonzalez. I'm a nurse at Woodland Healthcare.
You're all done. Not even a drop of blood.
She's
you're
good. She's so
you're
good.
All done. There you go. Thank you for getting vaccinated. You're welcome.
One of the very first times we went out to vaccinate people, we went to one of the hotels in West Sacramento. And it's kind of odd because, you know, all of a sudden you find yourself as a nurse drying up medications while you're sitting on the side of the sidewalk and there's things all around you that you would never draw up a medication in that situation. And there's people all around. And this guy came up on a bicycle and just kind of stuck his arm out there and we gave him a shot. It's like, it's so different from what you do when you're in the hospital. It's just, but it's good. It's a good thing.
I could just see when you were vaccinating that individual, that gentleman, that there's a lot of meaning in it for you as well, and a lot of gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice when you can look somebody in the eyes, and a lot of these people, sometimes they don't make eye contact with you. So a lot of the homeless, it's really nice when they look right back at you and you can really look them in the eye and try and relay, you know, how important it is that you got vaccinated, how thankful we are that you came, and, you know, that we respect you as an individual. And that's, you can say a lot just with your eyes.
Should we just bring it? Yeah, let's just bring a case.
Getting somebody to a second location is like the deal breaker.
My name is Nadia Wagner. I'm the homeless service coordinator with the County of Yolo.
Where are we heading right now?
We're going to walk over to some of the places that we know people hang out during the day in Davis. So there's a 7-Eleven across the street and some places that are shaded during the day that offer a little bit of respite from the heat. So sometimes people are just hanging out outside. We're going to go chat with some of them.
It seems like just gathering just the few minutes I've been here, this is kind of an organic process.
Completely organic. We will sometimes just go to a boat ramp where we know people hang out, and at the end of the day when we have vaccine left over, we'll stop at a gas station, a Mexican market. We've stopped people riding by on their bicycles to ask if they've had their vaccine yet and have had some success with it.
We've actually been driving by and asked people out the car window at a red light and then pulled over and gave them vaccines on their bikes from a red light.
I think that also lends itself to the reality that it's not that everyone is hesitant. It's more a convenience.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I completely agree. And amazingly, a lot of people we touch don't even know that the vaccine's being offered. We make all these assumptions because we watch TV and we think that everybody knows what's going on. And there's a lot of people that have no idea that the vaccine is even here and we're giving it out at all these locations.
I think also the delivery of the offer makes a big difference. And we've met a lot of people who have been at home watching the news and feel pretty distrustful of the government. But when it's a couple of really nice looking nurses and like friendly faces who are willing to have a conversation with you and ask what your concerns are and talk a bit about it, we've seen a lot of hard no's turn into yeses on the spot in the moment.
Yeah, human-to-human contact.
Human-to-human contacts, exactly. Yeah, and just willing to have that conversation.
My eyes set on this guy over there. I'm trying to get over there before he drives off. Darn it. Have you been vaccinated yet?
Pardon?
Have you had your COVID vaccine?
Oh, yeah.
Yet?
Okay.
Almost done. Yeah.
Good. Good. Very good. Yes.
Literally stopping people on the street.
Yes, that's what we do. I just see if there's anybody over here.
I'm Janine Rogers. I'm the administration manager at the hospital. I'm just here for the fun of it. I call myself the mere mortal of the group. I do paperwork very well.
She's really my handler.
Yeah.
So what just happened in that exchange with the woman parking?
She asks me what's going on because she sees we don't usually travel in big groups like this to be conspicuous because sometimes it does scare people off. But when they see us, she was asking what was going on. I said, we're giving COVID vaccines. Do you have yours? No, I'm double vaccinated. And she said, but you literally have the vaccines right there? I said, yes, we do. And she goes, yay. So,
right, because we're in the parking lot of a liquor store right now.
She thought it was a very good place to be, though.
So, Gina, you found someone.
Yes, I did. I think she's one of the owners of the store in here, and she's been very nervous. Her husband and her children are vaccinated, but she is not. So I think we're going to be able to vaccinate her.
Just walking into the 7-Eleven.
Just walking into 7-Eleven.
You're the homeless services coordinator for Yolo County. So you have a very intimate personal knowledge with this population that's unhoused. What have you learned over the last 6 months doing this?
So the County of Yolo, in partnership with Dignity Health, started doing outreach clinics to the hotels with Project Room Key, and vaccinated just about every one of our Project Room Key participants over a couple of weeks, and moved from there to doing unsheltered outreach with the Dignity Health crew. So we've been going to hotels, to encampments, to the shelter, to respite centers like we are today, to just going, we've literally gone door to door in areas where we know there are people living homeless who stay in hotel rooms for a night or two. So we've been bringing the vaccine to the clients where they are. For the past 6 months, every Friday we've been going out.
Yeah, I mean, we're standing in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven. So I think that leads to my next question. Supply isn't an issue now. What is the challenge now?
Oh, I think at this point, the challenge is, getting to the kind of back corners of our clients and our communities, really, to have conversations with people who aren't having conversations outside of their immediate families, people who are not talking to their doctor, people who are who don't have a lot of access to information about what the vaccine is or how to access it. I described it earlier as kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel as far as people who are on the fence, are maybes, or even could be no's turned to yeses once we have a conversation with them. So I think just kind of hand-to-hand, person-to-person conversations are what's turning people. At this point, we have supply, we have big clinics, people who want to show up at a vaccine clinic can and will. But the people that we're vaccinating today are people who aren't convinced, who aren't going to go out and pursue a vaccine or have questions about it. But we're talking to people sitting on sidewalks, sitting on park benches, sitting and fishing by the river, who just need a little bit more information and some kind faces, and are often willing, once we have somebody sitting across from them, to answer their questions.
I mean, even this morning, you've had some no's turn into yeses.
We have, yeah. There was a gentleman at the day respite center who was offered vaccine and initially said, no, thank you. That stuff gives you blood clots. To which I said, cut it. Are you open to having a conversation about that and learning a little bit more about that vaccine? And he kind of begrudgingly said yes. And we talked about, I was like, hey man, like here's a couple of facts. So what we know about this vaccine is that it has caused a number of blood clots. 5 out of 5 million known cases. It's happened in women between 18 and 49. Neither of those things apply to you. Knowing that, does that change your answer at all? And he said, oh, okay, yeah. But without that 5-minute conversation, this guy would have been a nah. Yeah.
And even right now, we're outside of a 7-Eleven because someone who was a little nervous about it is actually giving it a go just because you actually walked in and talked to them in person.
Exactly. Yeah, we've seen that too, that people who have previously been no's, sometimes even just by virtue of the community that they're in, we've had some people who at first approach have said, no, thank you, don't trust the government, believe that the vaccine is changing their DNA or contains a tracking device. When three very nice nurses sit down with you and answer some questions and they see that we are not evil government agents, but just people who are out trying to help, that personal relationship tends to really help and can get people over into a trusting yes.
Yeah. even with that uncertainty, that can be a barrier when you're asking people to physically go into a walk-in clinic or even as to go from across the street to a different location. That's why you guys are actually carrying the vaccines as you're walking down the street.
Right. Sometimes just having to go to a second location is the point where you lose somebody in that moment of engagement. So our team,
thank you very much.
Always carry a couple of vaccines. The nurses have a couple shots in their vials in their pocket, drawn up, ready to go. So when we're talking with people who are an uncertain no, who move to a yes, if we had to say, great, we'll see you at the clinic next Tuesday, here's your appointment card, they'd be gone forever. But the fact that we can sit down with them where they are and say, hey man, we can do this right now. Like, it takes just 5 minutes. We can do it right now. I know that you're busy, but it'll only take a moment. And sometimes that is where you get to a rolled up sleeve. It's been humbling. It's been completely humbling. It has changed the trajectory of like how I want to work in my field, in close partnership with a medical team at all times. Having partnership with nursing staff seems totally integral to doing homeless services. Having medical partners on board who can meet people's medical needs in partnership with somebody who knows the community, knows the individuals. I think it's a really symbiotic relationship. I know the individual people, I know where people live, I know how to talk to people and have their trust. And they have life-saving medicine and we can really help each other if we partner in that way. So I think that was probably one of the biggest takeaways that we want to figure out how to incorporate moving forward.
I love that. She literally like just ran out of the 7-Eleven and just saw someone biking down the street and is going after him. Sir, have you been vaccinated? Well, having a conversation.
Sure, right? Because that is not generally my approach, but she gets some wins.
And she's wonderfully charismatic
I mean, not everybody could do what Gina is doing. Like, she's brilliantly charismatic and kind. And it works. Look at her now.
The gentleman on the bicycle stopped, and they're actually having
a deep conversation.
A deep conversation about this.
Conversation, yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's surprising too. Sometimes the people that you think are going to be a hard no are not. They you just never know unless you ask everybody. The worst thing they can say is no, in like nice ways or less, in like more or less polite ways.
Talk about there's sometimes some pain, redness at the site, and then just some not everybody, but some general side effects: the headache, the feeling tired. Muscle aches, some a little nausea, and sometimes a fever.
What?
COVID we shot. Had COVID.
That's funny. Have a nice day. I'm not getting it.
COVID shot.
Hell no. I'm getting out.
Can we get you one?
I don't know. I don't like needles. Is she got that box?
It's really quick though. And it's a small needle that's really quick. And this is who I had give me mine. I mean, she's
mine too.
Hey, babe. You want to get a shot?
You got to set the example for her.
Okay, I'll allow that question.
Huh? I did. You want to get a shot? I don't know. I'm thinking about it. There you go, because she can't go. I'll get y'all next time.
All right.
He would have taken it if she hadn't come out.
Yeah, it seemed like it was literally just a matter of a minute or
he was going to take it. We were within a minute. Such a bummer.
But maybe you'll see him again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then now you're a familiar face.
And exactly. Mm-hmm. Now we've made the relationship, which, as Nadia can attest to, there's been a lot of people that we didn't get the first time around, especially at those room key motels. And then by the second, third time they saw us, they were willing. He would definitely get it if he was alone.
Oh, Gina, I also wanted to ask you, what happened inside the 7-Eleven?
Yeah, very exciting. So the owners of the store, a married couple, the husband has had his vaccine, mm-hmm. and some of their kids have had the vaccine, but the mom had not been vaccinated yet. She was afraid of needles. Again, it wasn't necessarily the vaccine she was afraid of needles. So we were able to talk to her. We went through the paperwork, talked to her all about it, and she ended up saying yes and getting vaccinated. And when she was done being vaccinated, she was so relieved. It's and I love to see that relieved look on their face, because they want it, but they're just so afraid of something. And so when they conquer their own fear and finally get it and feel safe, just that look on their face is worth it.
And that's just such an example of really that kind of that uncertainty, or just being scared of needles. Lots of people are scared of needles. That's the barrier to walking into a clinic, but not the barrier you actually going in face to face.
Absolutely. You can form a relationship with them, and they learn to trust you. And once people trust you a little bit, that's the key. You get people's trust and you see you're really out here trying to help them and do good. Then they kind of let go of their own little fears, because they want to do good for themselves as well.
I think what you're talking about is just meeting people where they are.
Exactly. Perfect example of meeting people where they are. Exactly. This is the hard work, and this is why this doesn't get done, because we're going to walk around the entire day and maybe get 20 vaccines done. And there's such a push right now to get needles in arms. So people want to post these numbers. I did 5,000 today. I did 2,000. So, but when you walk around, this is really about the quality of the vaccine and not the quantity. And so that's really what we're after, the quality of the people that we're getting.
Like even today, if you wrap up with just a handful or maybe a dozen, those dozen are very difficult to get.
Very difficult. They were afraid. They didn't know the vaccine existed. They were underserved. Exactly. So it really is, again, about the quality of the vaccines that we're giving today.
And that was Woodland Memorial Hospital Chief Nurse Gina Bravo, Nurse Susan Gonzalez, Hospital Administration Manager Janine Rogers, and Yolo County Homeless Services Coordinator Nadia Wagner. I tagged along with their mobile vaccine clinic in Davis on Friday and reaching out to vulnerable populations unable or unlikely to access traditional COVID-19 vaccination clinics. Still ahead, bats in the bypass. You heard that right. It's the time of year when the Mexican free-tailed bat colony takes root in the Yolo bypass. How you can catch the migration in person, and dates are already selling out. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, it's that time of year. You walk out onto the Yolo Bypass Wildlife Area off I-80. At sunset, you enjoy drinks and hors d'oeuvres and watch the spectacular view of hundreds of thousands of Mexican free-tailed bats take to the amber sky. Yes, bats. They migrate, and during summer, this colony calls Yolo Bypass home. The Yolo Basin Foundation, they host an annual Bat Talk and Walk event, or a series of events, to learn about their natural history and biology, and even get an up-close look at live bats. Tonight is the first of 2021 events, which runs through September. Corky Quirk is the bat expert, and she joins us with more on the summer programs, many of which have already sold out. Welcome to Insight, Corky.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you have a friend with us.
I do. I have a Mexican free-tailed bat. It is an ambassador. So this is one of the bats that come along on our programs. She was injured, and so she can't fly anymore. So I have a permit to be able to share her. And then people hopefully learn about them and maybe overcome some fears, if they have those fears, and really understand how important bats are to the ecosystem, and in particular to agriculture.
Yeah, when it comes to bats, or even the Mexican free-tailed bat, what is their personality like? How would you describe them?
So I would describe them as rather sweet, actually. They're quite calm. The Mexican free tail bat in particular is really well adapted to being around people. So if you're in the Sacramento area, they're often found in our buildings and our bridges and overpasses and such. They're not afraid of us, but they also don't attack. Bats are not aggressive. So you might hear them squeaking in the bridge or the parking garage, say.
So what has taken place this time of year? This is an annual migration, correct, over the Yellow Causeway off I-80?
Yeah, so in the winter, there's not a lot of insects. You know, it gets kind of cold at night. And so many of the bats will leave, and they'll go towards the Bay Area, or some of them might even go south. But then the weather starts to warm up, and they return. And around the end of June, each of the females in this bridge are going to give birth. And when they are nursing, or even when they're pregnant, they're pretty organized in the way they exit the bridge. So that's just a great time to come out and watch them fly.
And it's also a great opportunity, an educational opportunity, to understand why bats are important. Why are they important?
Yeah, so bats are extremely important to the ecosystem. They are our number one natural nighttime insect control. They're eating a tremendous amount of crop pests in particular. They also eat mosquitoes, which is rather nice for us, right? A female bat, when she's nursing or pregnant, she's going to eat about 20 moths a night. And moths, of course, lay eggs. And those eggs hatch into caterpillars. And the caterpillars eat our crops. So 20 moths could lay 500 eggs each. That's like, what, 10,000 eggs, 10,000 caterpillars out there eating, say, the corn or the rice. So these guys are extremely valuable to the farmers, but also to those of us who like to do backyard gardening, especially if you don't want to use pesticides. The bats are your best friend.
Well, what can one expect of a Yellow Basin Foundation Bat Talk and Walk? Tonight's the inaugural evening of a series of events that are going to be taking place throughout the summer.
Yeah, so we have about 50 or 60 evenings that we'll be going out to watch the bats. We do a virtual talk, and those are scattered also throughout the summer. So people can join in on Zoom from their own location, learn about the bats. Learn about bats in general, about the bats in the bypass, using a webcam like I'm doing right now with you. They can see the bats. I can show them various body parts, show them why they're called free-tailed, having this little tail that sticks out. And then on the evening of the event, we caravan through the wildlife area, learn a little bit about wetlands, see some of the birds that enjoy the rice that's being grown out there, get ourselves in position, and then watch the bats as they come out from underneath the bridge.
And there's a sizable number of bats if you catch it on the right night, correct?
Yeah, so it does vary somewhat from night to night, but at our peak, the estimate is about 250,000 on that bridge. And again, I mean, per bat, that's a lot of moth every night, right, exiting our skies.
Why are some people afraid of bats? And I asked that because I looked at the website and I think June is already sold out and some dates in July. So there's definitely an interest in watching these bats fly out at sunset.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of myths and misunderstandings about bats. You know, there are people who have heard that they attack. They don't attack. They're very docile animals. There's people that have heard that they're all sick with rabies. They're not. Just like a human, if a bat gets sick with rabies, it will die. So rabies is a horrible virus. Most bats are not sick with it, and it's passed through saliva. So if you don't ever touch the bat, you're not putting yourself at risk. Also, you know, there's the being tossed around the possibility of whether the virus that's causing COVID-19 maybe started in a bat in China. We know that even if a bat is sick with the virus, that COVID-19 it's not the same virus. It's similar, but it's not the same. We're not in China, so we don't have those species even. And we also know that the virus in the horseshoe bat in China cannot jump directly to a human. So, you know, when we first were in this pandemic and people were trying to figure things out, there were things that came out that weren't quite accurate that caused a lot of problems for the bats.
Well, it seems like there's actually a good number of people that want to take this in for the Bat Talk and Walk program. Corky Quirk is the bat expert with the Yellow Basin Foundation. Thank you for joining us. And thank you. I've never seen a Mexican free-tailed bat. Looking at one right now on Zoom.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. YOLOBASIN.org. People can learn more about our tours.
Yeah, we have that on our Insight page at capradio.org. So if you're interested in the events, you can just head over and then head over to the Yolo Basin Foundation. Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.